we've got a potentially hazardous asteroid, a beautiful astrophotography contest, and a new U.S. presidential administration. This week on Planetary Radio. I'm Sarah Al-Ahmed of the Planetary Society, with more of the human adventure across our solar system and beyond. The internet is all in a tizzy over the newly discovered asteroid 2024 YR4. It's currently the highest threat level posed by an asteroid, but should you worry? Our public education specialist, Kate Howells, gives us the details. Then Finn Burridge, science communicator at the Royal Observatory Greenwich, joins us to share how space imagers worldwide can participate in their Astronomy Photographer of the Year competition. From the skies, we turn our eyes to the changing political winds in the United States, as Casey Dreyer and Jack Corelli, our space policy team here at the Planetary Society, discuss how the first weeks of the new Trump administration have impacted NASA. We'll close out with What's Up with Bruce Betts, as he discusses the Chirino Impact Hazard Scale and how we determine the threat level posed by near-Earth objects. If you love Planetary Radio and want to stay informed about the latest space discoveries, make sure you hit that subscribe button on your favorite podcasting platform. By subscribing, you'll never miss an episode filled with new and awe-inspiring ways to know the cosmos and our place within it. We begin with asteroid 2024 YR4, a recently discovered near-Earth asteroid that's making the headlines. Don't panic, but there is a small chance that it could hit Earth on December 22, 2032. Kate Howells, our public education specialist, joins us from Canada to discuss her new article, Should You Be Worried About Asteroid 2024 YR4? Hey, Kate.
Hi, Sarah.
Well, this is a fun topic to bring you on for. I don't want anyone to panic, but we do have a really interesting asteroid that's just been detected. So you got the opportunity to write about this as quickly as possible because I know it really worried people. So should we be worried about asteroid 2024 YR4?
So the short answer is no. The longer answer is just a little bit more than you worry about asteroids generally, which shouldn't be very much. So the thing that's different about 2024 YR4, the very snappily named asteroid, is that it has about a 1% chance of colliding with Earth. And that is a lot higher than we usually get. Most asteroids that we detect have a 0% chance of colliding with Earth. So this one is unusual in that there's even a slight possibility that it'll hit us. Now, again, this is specifically talking about asteroids in this sort of size. Like little meteorites obviously hit the Earth, and we see those as shooting stars. But asteroids that are bigger than that very, very, very infrequently are found to be on a collision course with us. So this one is unusual, but I still say don't worry because we're going to be tracking it. We're going to be refining our understanding of its trajectory through space and where exactly it will be in space when it comes close to the Earth. And it's extremely likely that as we get more data, we will discover that no, it is not going to hit us. It'll just pass close to us.
What's its expected date of closest approach to Earth?
It is expected to pass close to Earth on December 22nd, 2032. So we've got a fair bit of time ahead of us to track it. And if, in the worst case scenario, we find that it is going to be on a collision course with Earth, we've got a lot of time to prepare something to deflect it.
How big is this object?
Right now, it looks like it's about somewhere between 40 to 100 meters in diameter. So that's about 130 to 330 feet. But again, follow-up measurements are going to help get that number a little bit more precise.
But either way, we're not talking about like a world-destroying, like Chicxulub dinosaur event. It's probably something smaller, but could still create some devastation locally if it did hit.
Yeah, absolutely. You don't want something this big hitting the Earth. If it hit in water, it could create tsunamis. If it exploded over the air, like the Chelyabinsk event, that was in Russia in the 2010s, and all these windows exploded and buildings throughout the whole city, that kind of thing could happen. Or if it did actually strike the ground, it would create an impact crater and an explosion. So none of these are things that you want. It's not going to wipe out the entire planet or kill 90% of the species that exist on the Earth, like previous impacts may have, but it's still something you really want to avoid. So what is important here is to continue observing this object and get all those follow-up measurements to really know its trajectory and its size.
We only detected this because of its last close approach by Earth, right? So it's actually swinging by us pretty regularly.
Yeah, space is very full of asteroids. I mean, as much as technically it's very empty and everything's very far apart, there are a lot of asteroids out there, and they swing past Earth as they go around the sun, or they are on the opposite side of the sun from Earth as they swing past like the plane of our orbit. So we do get a lot of close passes, but things that are looking to pass this closely are very rare.
How does this compare to something like Apophis that's going to be flying by in 2029? So we've got everyone kind of gearing up for that big moment, and this object is coming closer to us than our geostationary satellites, but now we've got another one we've got to worry about.
Well, yeah, Apophis, when we first discovered it, we weren't sure if it was going to hit Earth or not. So it actually is the only asteroid that's ever had a higher rating on the Torino Impact Hazard Scale, which is what scientists use to kind of rank how likely something is to hit Earth and be devastatingly destructive. So Apophis, when it was discovered in 2004, had a rating of 4, whereas 2024 YR4 has a rating that could be as high as 3. So both of those are, you know, significant, keep an eye on these things kind of ratings. But then Apophis, as we studied it more, it went down to 0. So we now know that it's not going to hit us. It's going to come really close, which is actually great for asteroid science because we can study it as it passes close to us. We don't have to go all the way out to deep space where we often go visit asteroids. We'll actually have one coming close by. So perhaps 2024 YR4 will have a similar outcome where we'll find out that it's going to pass close enough that we can study it.
And that's cool because we already have so many missions that are gearing up between the United States and the European Space Agency to try to check out Apophis. Perhaps we could repurpose some of that for 2024 YR4 if it gets that close. Fingers crossed it doesn't, though. But
yeah, absolutely. The more we do this kind of thing, the more we develop the technology to be able to, you know, go study an asteroid up close, that kind of thing, the better prepared we are to do it again if we get another opportunity. So it's our job to put these things into context and explain how people should actually interpret this news and what they should think about it and whether they should be worried. And in this case, it is sort of this middle ground of don't ignore this. We don't want the world scientists to ignore this. But average people, don't let this disrupt your life. Don't lose any sleep over it. We interviewed Heidi Hamel, the vice president of our board of directors, who's also a planetary scientist. We asked her about this asteroid because she and her colleagues are involved in tracking it, conducting observations to better understand it. And she said very clearly, your danger is far higher to have a car crash. So wear your seatbelt. That's something you should actually worry about. This is not.
Well, it's good news and a good opportunity for science. And one more example of just how wonderfully our system right now, people around the world trying to track and detect asteroids, is working. And it's about to get so much better with instruments like Neo Surveyor in space. So it's making me feel a lot safer knowing just how many of these objects we found. And that in all that space, all those rocks, this is the one that we have to be the most worried about. And we don't really have to worry that much.
Exactly. Yeah, it's always good to keep an eye on the skies and make sure that we're prepared to find things that could be dangerous and deal with them if they are dangerous. So it's so important to continue funding planetary defense efforts around the world and supporting things like the International Asteroid Warning Network that help coordinate all of that. But yes, I'm not going to be freaking out yet about this one.
Yeah, not a don't look up situation yet.
Not yet, thank goodness.
Well, thanks for sharing this with us, Kate, and hopefully we've made some people feel a little less scared about space rocks.
Yes, if you ever hear anything on the news that frightens you about asteroids, just go to planetary.org, and if it's a real threat, we'll have information on it.
Yeah, we have your back. Thanks, Kate.
Thanks, Sarah.
Some people image the sky to protect us from near-Earth objects, but others do it strictly for the pretty pictures. There are many ways to share and enjoy astrophotography, but one of my favorite ways is through the Royal Observatory Greenwich's Astronomy Photographer of the Year competition. As the name suggests, the Royal Observatory Greenwich is located in Greenwich Park in London, UK. It's the home of Greenwich Mean Time. It's a great spot if you want to get a selfie standing on the prime meridian. right before you go into London's only planetarium. The images that come out of this competition every year absolutely blow my mind, and entries are now open. Whether you like taking space pictures or simply marveling at the beauty of space, you'll want to keep this one on your radar. Finn Burridge, science communicator at the Royal Observatory Greenwich, joins us now to share how you can participate. Hey, Finn, thanks for joining
me. Oh, hi, no worries. It's great to join you.
I'm so glad to speak with you because there are so many wonderful astrophotographers around the world and so many wonderful ways to get out that imagery. But each year, the contest I look forward to the most is the one that you guys hold. How did this all begin?
Well, it's a long-running competition, and it began way back in 2009. So we have been running it for a long time now. And we wanted to celebrate kind of this, what was a hobby, and this passion that many people have to photograph the night sky. Of course, back in 2009, technology is not what it was today. And, you know, people had to go, they'd drive out right into the sticks and were really, really dark, trying to get these fantastic images of galaxies. Back when, you know, the best images were space telescopes. You had to wait for Hubble or another space telescope to come out and publish some of the best. And we wanted to celebrate that people could really take images that could rival some of these space telescopes if you put in the time, if you put in the hours. And now here we are 16 years later, and some of the images coming out of the competitions now are just absolutely incredible. And I think it's just a really joyful way of celebrating astronomy.
I agree. And I love that you break it out into so many different topics of different things that you can take images of, because there's so much different technical skill depending on whether or not you're imaging the sun versus imaging a nebulae. There's a wide skill variety there.
Yeah, I mean, we thought it was right, really, to break it into different categories to kind of respect the different technique skills that people have. You know, it's very, very different to go out and take a picture of a deep sky galaxy somewhere where, you know, it does have to be dark. You've got to have a big telescope, lots of collecting power over, let's say, kind of the aurora, where you need to go somewhere really far north. It's not necessarily about a big telescope, and it's more about your artistic expression. You get a great aurora display. Have you got a good foreground? And there are lots of different categories now which celebrate all these different kind of techniques, genres, if you like, of astrophotography. My personal favorite is probably galaxies. It's an area I studied, and I think it's amazing now the kind of images that we get from galaxies. But yeah, lots of talent in all the categories today.
And the contest is open to people from all around the world. How far reaching have your submissions been?
Well, last year we had 58 countries, people from 58 countries submit. So we get people from all around the world. It's a real international call out. More and more people getting submissions every year. We had well over 3,000 entries this year, and we're hoping for more this year. And I think that brings a real joy to the competition, because you get places, different cultures, you get different people celebrating parts of the sky that mean a lot to them. And it's wonderful to see from around the world how people kind of change their taste, if you like. This year, interestingly, a lot of our submissions from China, they were very bright. It's kind of the thing this year to have very, very bright foregrounds, really colorful images. Whereas in different places around the world, they prefer kind of more muted tones, shall we say. And it's really interesting to see how different places have different tastes for the sky.
It'd be really interesting to look through all the images based on where they come from and see those commonalities and try to pick out themes. That's really cool.
Yeah.
What is the process of trying to whittle down these images to find your final winners like? Because that's a lot of images.
It's tricky. So we have a team of real expert judges, and they do the kind of final cut, if you like. And then inside the museum, myself included, we have a larger team of astronomers who shortlist. So we might get, for some of the categories like stars and nebula, hundreds and hundreds of submissions, and we have to get it down to around about 15 to 20 before we take it to final judges. And it really is a process of, have they got the technical skill? Is the image beautifully crafted? Has it got a wow factor? Is it something we haven't seen before? All of these things can contribute to whether an image will make the shortlist or not. And it is tricky. It takes 2 or 3 weeks to get the shortlist complete as we all pool our minds together. all of us looking at a category kind of each, and then we come together and kind of cross-reference each other to make sure that we're not missing a brilliant image, or you know, one person's taste hasn't dominated one of the categories. And then once the shortlist is complete, we'll pass that to the final judges, who will decide on the winner. And I don't envy that position, because it's, by the time you get to 12 images, you know, you're splitting hairs, because some of these images that we get now are such high quality. It's really, really tough to pick the final image unless you get a brilliant one that just stands out above the rest. But that's sort of the process. We have a kind of shortlisting process, weeks and weeks of going through these hundreds of submissions, and then a final judging panel to do the winners.
Yeah, I was recently on a naming panel to try to help name a quasi-moon of Earth. Very similar process. Wow. And yeah. I tell you, it is so hard to pick a winner in the end, but eventually you do. What happens when a person wins this contest?
The overall winner obviously wins the grand prize, so they get a bit of a monetary reward, and they have the joy and pride of having it displayed in our gallery alongside each category winner as well. So every year, once the winners are announced, we'll have an award ceremony. So the winner will be kind of invited to accept the prize. We have a short film made about, if we can, about them and their process and how they created their masterpiece. And then all the winners will have their photo on display for the rest of the year in our APY gallery in London, in the National Maritime Museum, for members of the public to come and see. So you have your photo displayed publicly.
And I want to share as well, if people want to have a little bit of this in their own home, you do produce a full calendar of all the winning images as well. And that's one of my favorite ways to kind of have that in my home.
Yeah, we do. It's great. The kind of at the museum, obviously, we have kind of every edition of the book that has been made, and that has all the shortlists in as well. So even if you didn't make runner up, if you're on the shortlist, you get into the book, and it's a great way to see kind of how the competition has evolved over time.
That's beautiful. So how do people actually submit their images to you?
So if you head to our website, Royal Museums Greenwich, Astrophotographer of the Year 2025, you'll find on there a link to submit your images alongside the rule set. So each category has its own rule set. Some, for example, like the Annie Maunder Prize, we've opened it up this year. We've made it even more creative. We've kind of relaxed some of the tools that we had previously not allowed. Now we want as much creativity as possible. So for example, this year we're allowing kind of AI editing. We have to use real data. So this is a really interesting category, actually. I should probably speak about it. We want people to take real astronomy data and make something amazing out of it. So be as artistic, be as creative as you like. This year's winner was fantastic, actually. We had a person who took weather satellite data of the Earth from space and kind of flipped the colors on it to make it look like an exoplanet. And it was kind of, how would an alien see our world? And using the real weather data that shows our changing climate, he created a kind of exoplanet under threat to raise awareness of our challenges that we face on Earth. That was a really interesting submission, and we want more like that. It's a really interesting category. So we want people to head on over to the website, read those rules, see what you're allowed to submit, and then submit your images.
It's going to be fascinating to see what people come up with these new tools. Things are changing so rapidly, but that is also one of my favorite categories, turning astrophotography into it's already an art, but this kind of, you know, more profound, more artistic way of trying to interpret the data. It's beautiful.
Yeah.
When do people actually find out whether they win? Like, when can we see the winning images?
So this year, it will be towards the end of September when we'll announce the winner publicly. The winner themselves may find out just before then if they are invited. If you get an overall winning category, you'll find out slightly before so that you can come to the award ceremony, of course. But it's only a few days before the actual public announcement at the end of September.
Oh, wow. Oh, and I didn't ask, when's the deadline? I think we only have a little bit left.
So yeah, the deadline for this year is the 3rd of March. So we don't have too long, less than a month, if you want to submit your images. So if you do have any, or if you want to go out and take any in the next few days. I mean, we've still got a planetary parade in the sky at the minute, which is really, really cool. So there's still time. Get your images in by the 3rd of March.
Beautiful. Well, I know that this year's images are going to blow my mind all over again. I can't wait for all of our listeners to have an opportunity to look at these. If you haven't been checking out this contest, I highly encourage it because I've been doing it for over a decade and every year it brings me such joy. So thank you for putting this on. I know it is a massive undertaking, but from me to you, it's a beautiful contest and I think it is absolutely one of my favorites of the year.
Oh, thank you very much. And it brings us joy as well. It's a really fun project to be involved with, seeing what people can come up with. And to be honest, it's a joy going through all of the hundreds of images that get submitted. So many of them could make the final shortlist. It is a lot of fun for us to put on.
Well, thanks so much and good luck on the judging and good luck to everyone submitting your images.
Yeah, good luck to everybody.
As always, I'll drop a link for the contest on the webpage for this episode of Planetary Radio. Our perspective on space isn't just about what we see. It's about the policies that determine what and how we explore next. There's much to discuss in space politics as the Trump administration returns to the White House. The Planetary Society is a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization with members all around the world. For 45 years, we've worked with U.S. legislators and presidents to help shape the future of space exploration. Casey Dreyer, our Chief of Space Policy, and Jack Corelli, our Director of Government Relations, join us now to discuss this moment in space policy and what you can do to help support NASA's programs and workers. Hi, Jack and Casey.
Hey, Sarah.
Hi, Sarah. How's it going?
All right. There's been a lot going on in space policy recently, so I wanted to make sure that we took a moment to really talk about what was going on, because I know a lot of people are curious about how things have been going at NASA since Trump and their administration came in recently. So what have you guys been seeing? What has your week been like?
Pretty quiet. Jack, you've been working at all? I've really just been taking it easy.
Yeah, no, it really, not much to follow on the news.
Yeah, Sarah, it's been crazy. We need to separate out two things, I think, to talk about space policy in particular, which is there's no distinct new space policy yet. And what we're seeing happen at NASA and within the science agencies of the U.S. government more broadly is more of a function of these broad sweeping executive orders that the president issued, you know, on the first day and then subsequent days. We'll talk about one that was rescinded, but functionally, I think it's important to keep in mind that NASA is executing what the White House is directing it to do. And we're seeing the impacts of it pretty quickly, and it's hitting pretty bluntly in terms of how these are being applied. That's probably intentional, but it's happening very fast. And that's, in this case, you know, somewhat unusual for how government acts. And this is what Jack and I have been trying to keep up on.
Yeah. I mean, it's evolving situation, right? And it's something that is part of why we have organizations like the Planetary Society to keep track of how these things evolve over time and what impacts that might have on space policy. So yeah, Casey and I have been actively keeping track of all the new information and implementation of that information as it comes out.
Yeah. And we can just mention, I mean, so the things that's really hitting NASA that we're seeing. So there's executive directives regarding the concept of DEIA, regarding gender, you know, very strong, I think it's fair to say, culture war related issues. And part of those executive orders basically say that federal agencies cannot participate or generally even acknowledge even the terms. And they set very strict and immediate deadlines for when these things had to be taken off of public activities and also from public websites. And so what that's actually resulted in, and, you know, I'll add too that they were somewhat vaguely written within the orders themselves. There's not a clear definition, nor is there a clear bar to clear. And so I'd say the fairest understanding of what's happening within organizations like NASA is that you have their legal counsel saying, okay, these orders say this, we need to err on the side of extra caution. And so we're going to, if there's any doubt, NASA's been essentially just taking it down. And this, what do I mean by taking it down? Well, we've seen websites. Some of the Solar System Exploration Virtual Institute has gone down. We've seen the policy directives, NASA's internal policy directives, which included probably statements about diversity and inclusion that are, you know, the website was gone. We're seeing some grant reporting, you know, grants had been actually encouraged and required to engage on a broader and diverse kind of consequences when they would execute them. NASA has erred on the side of just removing them in total in order to, you know, theoretically scrub some of those words out of there. And they claim this is temporary. we have no reason not to believe them yet. This is at the NASA level, but it is hard to say. We don't know because we don't have that transparency about what needs to be done. And NASA itself may not fully even know that. We just don't know when a lot of these pieces of content will come back.
Well, it's a good thing to remember that the federal government is very large. NASA itself is, of the discretionary budget, not counting mandatory spending, 0.39% of that budget. So that means that there is still 100% of the budget that needs to implement these executive orders. And so obviously, certain policy decisions that the administration and Congress will be working on in the coming months affect one agency more than another. These are sweeping, right? And so it's up to those individual agencies to implement what they see as the best definition of that executive action that is requested. And so that is, I think, maybe the source of a lot of the confusion, right, that has come out of these, is that the implementation is varied based on agency. And as we've seen, the White House has gotten involved in sort of clarifying over time what these executive actions mean. And so it's sort of the messy nature of government, right? Is it is a large institution, multiple large institutions, trying to get them all to do one thing is very difficult, right? It's people. And so at the end of the day, that implementation is taking different forms in different parts of the government. And with NASA, we're seeing it take this form.
Additionally, I'd say the other things that we've noticed are NASA has shut down all all scientific input panels. These things are called analysis groups and various other technical information groups. And these usually feed into what's called the NASA Advisory Council. They got notices the other week that these were all to suspend meetings until, and this is kind of the standard language, right, Jack? Like, until we can assure compliance with the executive orders. So these executive orders keep getting issued and keep getting clarified. So I think that's part of the ongoing uncertainty, you know, to put it nicely, about what's going on. But at the end of the day, also, NASA is a public agency. And what makes a public agency distinct from a private agency or a private organization or a private company is that it answers to the public. It has an accountability. So from a legal point of view, the executive has the right, in a sense, to direct these types of activities broadly. What we need to see, regardless, though, is explanations from NASA, transparency from NASA, standards, communication from NASA, and we're not seeing that much of that. And I think that's in a sense the more troubling aspect at a very fundamental level for me as an old institutionalist democracy guy, constitutionalist democracy guy, is that at the end of the day they need to be at minimum committing to transparency. And Jack, you were there. That was one of our core recommendations to both the transition team and to the administration itself, is that lean into NASA's unique status as a public agency. And again, what does that mean? It's not just doing things that the private industry won't do. It's doing things that has a fundamental responsibility to the public that private industry just does not by its definition. And so the lack of transparency, the lack of openness, that to me is the real core of this. And that's something, I mean, we're only as we record this, 2.5 weeks? This could resolve once they kind of settle down. But again, there's other issues out there that we may address here as well.
I imagine it's really difficult to be transparent about what your actions are if you're not clear on what actions you should be taking. So maybe they're trying to take a more measured approach and not be very open about what's happening until they're more clear on what steps they need to take.
Well, and that's, I think, evident from the fact that so much of the notice that has been put out publicly in compliance with the executive orders has been boilerplate. It's mm-hmm. taken from the orders themselves or from instruction from the Office of Management and Budget or from, you know, the acting administrator of NASA, Janet Petro. And so they're sort of keeping the line of communication pretty clear where they can, where the information's coming from, and reusing that language so that everyone seems to be as much as possible on the same page about the direction.
Jack, you mentioned something that's important to emphasize, is that we still don't have a NASA administrator confirmed by the Senate. And as we record this in early February, Jared Isaacman still doesn't have a schedule on the Senate confirmation process and calendar. Maybe in the next few months is I believe what we're hearing. And so all of this is kind of happening with an acting, you know, a temporary leadership at NASA. And so there's, at the same time, a leadership void, right? There's no confirmed leadership staff there. And so, again, they have to be there to execute what the White House says, because they are, at the end of the day, as we've always said, an executive agency that is directed by the president. And so that adds this extra layer of caution, I would guess, from their perspective, that they are not empowered with any leadership in a sense of they're there as a caretaker. And so beyond that, you know, there's kind of not a lot of individualistic kind of leadership goals being executed there. We should note a few other things that we've seen that kind of particularly fit into the transparency and openness. One is that apparently there is a new NASA senior advisor to the administrator that has very close ties with Elon Musk, had led human spaceflight activities at SpaceX for many years. And we didn't learn about that except for a report by Eric Berger on Ars Technica. The path forward is similarly uncertain. And this is where I think it's, you know, despite everything I just said, NASA, relative to some federal agencies, is doing relatively well, right? In the case that they are not being actively dismantled. Now, we have no idea if that will eventually happen to NASA. You know, there's this whole broad talk of cuts, and the range of potential outcomes here are very large. And at the moment, because this is happening quickly, right, this is kind of the hack that's happening. This is moving faster than the speed of bureaucracy to respond to it. But there is response. And I think at the end of the day, despite not vocally saying much at the moment, Congress does have an opportunity to weigh in, and that will be coming up. I think we'll see more and more of that in the next few weeks and months.
And that's, I think you said the key word there, Congress. Three branches of government, and Congress has a very active role to play in both oversight and authorization of the activities of the federal government, and then also the other key function of Congress, appropriation. And so how the Congress appropriates funds for the remainder of this current fiscal year, you know, we're currently in fiscal year 2025 up through September 30th. We have a deadline coming up, March 14th, for a continuing resolution, whether the Congress decides to go forward with a full year stopgap funding measure, which would be an unprecedented move in the first year of an administration, or if they are able to put together a full budget for the remaining 6 months. And then they're going to have to turn right around and start deliberating on fiscal year 2026. And so the funding conversation, right? Congress appropriates these funds a lot of times for very specific purposes. They're going to have a huge say. And both the appropriations committees in the House and the Senate have a very strong voice when it comes to federal spending and oversight, and as do the authorizing committees. We've seen letters from, I believe, both chambers to that effect, looking for, as Casey, you were describing, the improved transparency for what is currently happening across all of government, but then specifically at NASA, why certain decisions are being made, and if there is any through line directly to the executive orders.
We'll be right back after the short break.
I'm Jack Corelli, Director of Government Relations for the Planetary Society. I'm thrilled to announce that registration is now open for the Planetary Society's flagship advocacy event, the Day of Action. Each year, we empower Planetary Society members from across the United States to directly champion planetary exploration, planetary defense, and the search for life beyond Earth. Attendees meet face-to-face with legislators and their staff in Washington, D.C. to make the case for space exploration and show them why it matters. Research shows that in-person constituent meetings are the most effective way to influence our elected officials, and we need your voice. If you believe in our mission to explore the cosmos, this is your chance to take action. You'll receive comprehensive advocacy training from our expert space policy team, both online and in person. We'll handle the logistics of scheduling your meetings with your representatives, and you'll also gain access to exclusive events and social gatherings with fellow space advocates. This year's Day of Action takes place on Monday, March 24th, 2025. Don't miss your opportunity to help shape the future of space exploration. Register now at planetary.org/dayofaction.
We can hope that they resolve the budget and figure that out, because we did see what happened last year when it was delayed. It had dire consequences for many of the NASA facilities. They had to have massive layoffs in places like JPL. So we're really hoping that they do find the funding to do this. But clearly there is a will to try to cut back on funding for many of these grant programs. And you did allude to that earlier, Casey.
There was a moment in the first week where the Trump administration proposed to freeze funding for federal programs. It was ultimately retracted, but a lot of science teams were impacted. How did that resolve?
So they proposed to pause, and it was, at this point, this is old news, even though it basically took up 2 or 3 full days of Jack and I's life as it was happening. But yeah, I mean, that was a very blunt force proposal. I mean, I guess it was ruled by a judge. It was stayed by a judge as not having the legal authority to do that, ultimately. But it caused a lot of disruption, right? Because you pause all grant and federal assistance just in the NASA world. What does that mean? That means science grants to individual scientists who pay their students, who pay their postdocs. Pays the income of National Science Foundation postdocs at a university trying to get their degrees. It funds various research institutions. It funds mission operations. Lots of things that are quite useful. And, you know, there's a role in our democracy to debate proper levels of funding, but it's not set up to have basically to pull the plug in the middle of it. And that's where the disruption was coming from. So part of that, you know, Jack was out all day on the Hill, but I was putting together, we analyzed, you know, NASA's 40,000 some contracts, and we had very quickly were able to put together a conservative estimate that it would impact every state in the country. Some funding goes to every, and this is just the science, you know, and technical grant side of NASA, over 250 different congressional districts, you know, hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars of funding were temporarily held up. Thankfully, that got unfrozen, and people for the moment assume that that's coming down. Now, there are other issues regarding grant funding for DEA activities, which is now forbidden, and there's issues that people have to stop doing that right away, and then there's potential issues with money, you know, how that was distributed and so back. Again, a lot's happening that we're trying to keep up with. So, Sarah, I think we've touched on all the bad stuff. Can we talk a little about what we're doing? Because we are doing things, and I think that's when it happens very fast like this, it can be hard both from the inside to get our message out, and also from if you're sitting on the outside to kind of peer in and see what we're doing. And that's an understandable frustration, I think, is that when it's, you know, Jack and I are trying to keep up as well and understand what's happening. And Jack, I think it's fair to say we're not the only ones.
It's the entire policy community in D.C. I'm in a number of group chats trying to figure it out. Right. It's the nature of the beast right now, right?
Yeah.
And I think it's just, I will just say, as someone who does this professionally, just an exacerbation of the normal day-to-day, right? It's a lot of information, a lot of people involved, a lot of organizations. And this is just an extreme case, right, of a lot of information really quickly. But yeah, we're all operating, I think, on the same set of information that everyone else is.
Well, part of what makes this unusual, and I'm going to, you know, again, we're trying to stay away from because we're not a partisan organization. And maybe this is a good time to just mention that we worked really well with the first Trump administration on their space policy, and they had a very smart space policy program. So this isn't a partisan thing, but I think what's unique this time that makes this more challenging from a policy perspective is that there's no clear policy decision apparatus at work here. It's very centralized, and so very hard to, right? You can model systems, right? When you can do an N equals 1 million, you know, model system, you can kind of look at overall impacts much easier than if you had to model one thing very precisely because of all the idiosyncrasies of that one thing, and this being a person, right? And so because the decisions are coming from such a small group of people, the processes that of policy in terms of how we set agendas and discuss and define things aren't really functioning in the same way right now. And that's, in a sense, that's the rapid adjustment that, you know, we and other groups are trying to make to say, is there even an input process for these things? Now, again, Congress is kind of, we're talking about administration here. Congress is still Congress, and Congress is going to act on its schedule. it's just going to be slower. And so that is still the avenue for public engagement, because at the end of the day, the executive, only has to go up for election once every 4 years. And Congress is the check on executive power. Executive checks Congress and judicial check, you know, right? This is a hard structure of government. And so if there's this kind of broad frustration, and then I think understandably it's that it's the system itself is under a strange, is in a strange superposition right now because of this. And so one of the things that we're going to be doing at the Society is more things like this, Sarah, right? And also for those of you who are members in our member community, part of this is just communication, frankly, right? And so we're going to really be trying to up our frequency and access so we can, at minimum, Jack and I can be here to share what do we see, what are we seeing and how do we interpret this? And we're trying to do the same with other organizations to try to bring information in to us. And we can at least talk about what is happening. And give you, as like listeners and members of the Planetary Society, as much information as we can about what we're seeing. The second thing we're going to be doing is really leaning into our values as an organization. And this actually is a strategy we identified last year, which is that we believe that space exploration, and right, we're just going to focus on space exploration because that's our job as the Planetary Society. Space exploration almost requires a broad coalition of people who share a fundamental set of values: curiosity, exploration, ambition, excitement, challenge. These are nonpartisan and non-political shared values. And so leaning into and appealing to values, and this is where I keep talking about openness and transparency and inclusion and optimism. We list our values at the organization, and that's what we're going to abide by, that we get to represent these values to the people making decisions and the people in Congress and our policymakers, that we are going to be a voice for those. The next thing we're going to be doing is engaging with other scientists and other organizations as much as we can to both share information and work on shared interests and shared projects. So all of these things are kind of, it's like what we've been doing, but more so. And Jack, do you want to add onto that at all in terms of like your day-to-day, what you see happening in DC for yourself? Yeah,
well, I'll be returning probably more frequently than before to the hallowed halls of Congress and working very closely with our partner organizations on shared interests, and also utilizing the groundwork that we laid in the past few years with the Planetary Science Caucus. And that is a great way for us to activate our members, but also activate members of Congress, people that have stood up and said that this is important, and where decisions and opportunities arise, where we can advance those key policy priorities and recommendations that align with our values. The caucus is a great mechanism. And so I guess I can say this on air now that it's official, but the caucus is formally refiled with the 119th Congress. We are hitting the ground running already here in DC. And so being willing, open, and able to accept these opportunities and to use the platforms that we have to advance that shared vision for the exploration of the cosmos.
And no matter who you are or what your political preference is, space is something that brings all of us together. And this isn't just about us personally and what we do at the Planetary Society, but us facilitating what everybody else who loves space can do to help NASA get the funding that it needs and to make sure that we can do all these wonderful planetary exploration missions. Thankfully, we've got some wonderful opportunities for people online to help write their members of Congress and hopefully encourage them to join the caucus. But we also have our Day of Action coming up, and I'm happy to announce that all three of us are going to be there. So how can people who are excited about this join us in Washington, D.C.? Because I'm hearing from you that we're already seeing a record number of people signing up.
Yeah, it is amazing to see that so many people have signed up so far. I'm looking through the list every day, basically, and it's old friends, people that have, you know, it's their fourth or fifth time doing a Day of Action. But then for about half of them, it's their first time ever, which is truly exciting to see. And so you just have to go to planetary.org/dayofaction and sign up. We take care of organizing your schedule, of getting you to the places where your voice is needed most, providing you with those details and a comprehensive training so that you can turn your passion into legislative action on the Day of Action, March 24th. Planetary.org/dayofaction. It truly is the most impactful thing that our advocacy program has done. And I hear it every day, literally as of recording this 3 days ago, an office I have never met with before said, I remember you from the office I worked in prior to this one because of the day of action. And so this is things that stick around that is part of the institutional memory on Capitol Hill and really makes an impact that people from all walks of life, of all partisan persuasions and ideologies can come together under this common banner of space science and exploration truly makes a difference.
Well said, Jack. On our member community, the only politics at the Planetary Society are space politics. All are welcome if you share these values of wanting to see more space and more space exploration and executed efficiently. And I think that's the thing. When you can look at, and Sarah, I've neglected to mention at the beginning, we do have official recommendations to the new administration now. And, you know, one of the things the society emphasizes is that we're not afraid of change. I think change is necessary in a lot of things that NASA is doing. But, right, we have the but. It has to be strategic and it has to be consensus driven. And maybe that's worth mentioning here at the end of the day. Orbital mechanics is a merciless, unforgiving entity, right? In that you do not get to choose what congressional term or presidential term that your launch windows and traverse times and landing opportunities occur. Space is big, right? As our boss, Bill says, there's a lot of space in space. And if you want to do anything functionally, when you start building something new to finding the time to launch it, to getting where it's going, to the time your data gets back or whoever, if it's people going, it usually takes certainly more than 2 years and almost always more than 4 years. Space is a relay. And you're handing this, I like this visual now, the space baton, from one congressional and White House administration to the next, because you just can't move that fast. And it's not that NASA's inefficient and private industry can move faster. No, this is the alignment of planets that limit this. And so the consensus, that this is, again, one of our key values that we've talked about, and this is the opportunity, right, to change this. Like, space doesn't have to be another partisan area of fighting, and it so far hasn't been. Space can be this one area of unification or shared values or shared exploration because it has to be. And this is what the first Trump administration knew exceedingly well. When they designed the Artemis program, they knew that it would be finished by a different administration. And it was the first return to the moon program ever in U.S. history to survive a transition to not just the next presidential administration, but one of the opposite party. And that says a lot about the consensus building that they did in that first term. This has to be part of this, as you know. So when change does come to NASA, if they want it to last, if they want it to succeed beyond 4 years, beyond the 2 year congressional cycle, there has to be some consensus building. And that'll be one of the key messages that we're going to bring. And that's the opposite of a divisive message, right? Like, by definition, that is a unifying message. And then leaning into this idea of it's a public agency and it owes us accountability and transparency and openness. These are the types of things we're going to be there to talk about a lot this year, not just numbers and funding. These are broad philosophical opportunities we have to remind people that space does bring out the best in us and can bring out the best in us. And it's still a huge opportunity, despite the trouble that NASA as an institution is going through now. That's what we're going to be focusing on.
Well, thanks for trying to navigate these complex times and keep all of us, including me, updated on everything. And I really look forward to seeing you all in Washington, D.C. And thank you to everyone who's going to be joining us and adding their voices to try to support space exploration, because it really does bring us together. And now is the time that we need all of our voices to help support all of these scientists and our wonderful programs.
Can I add one more thing, Sarah? Because I, anyone who listens to my show knows I get amped up about talking about space. So I'll go on. Two things I just want to mention, emphasize, if you're listening. The Space Advocate newsletter, it's coming back this February. We will have the link in the show notes. That's another way in which you can follow along what's going on. And then if you're not a member, become a member, because on the community, on our online digital community, Jack and I are on that too. And we have a whole space policy section. So we're trying to do a lot more communication there. And engagement there, and you can ask us questions, and we have online briefings and other types of things, as news is developing. So we want to talk to you, and we want to give you as many tools as you can. So if you want newsletters or online communities or so forth, you have your options. And of course, this wonderful podcast, Sarah, that you host so well. lots of ways to engage, and we hope you will engage with us.
Well, thanks so much, and good luck with everything in the coming months. I know it's going to be a lot, but I don't trust any two people on Earth to do it better and more fair and with as much kindness as you two do. So thank you.
Thank you, Sarah.
The Planetary Society's space recommendations for the second Trump administration are available on our website if you'd like to learn more. And while I'm in Washington, D.C. for our Day of Action, I'm going to be hosting a Planetary Radio live show at the Library of Congress. If you're in the area, please consider joining us. Now it's time for What's Up with Dr. Bruce Betts, our chief scientist. I have more questions about hazardous asteroids, and he's exactly the person to ask. Hey, Bruce.
Hey, Sarah.
So earlier in this episode, I got to talk to Kate about the new hot topic asteroid, 2024 YR4. Glad to hear that it's probably not going to hit us, but, you know, a 1%, 2% chance is pretty high.
We haven't had this much excitement since Apophis seemed like it might hit. And fortunately, Apophis, which is even significantly bigger, is not hitting, but doing a flyby in 2029. So this one, yeah, the odds are, both now, the percentage is low, but odds are the percentage of probability of hitting will drop to zero at some point. But you need to get more and more observations over time to figure out the orbit precisely enough to know that for sure.
In the article, you were quoted saying that the odds of impact could go up before they drop to zero. Why is that?
Yeah, it's very counterintuitive. But if you want the baseball analogy or the asteroid discussion.
Well, you know, I just watched a sport ball yesterday. So let's go with sports.
Okay, sports for 100. So when you got a pitcher and they're going to throw at the catcher, and the catcher's got the catcher's mitt right where they want it, and they're not going to move that catcher's mitt. That's Earth. Pitcher's throwing an asteroid. What happens is as soon as it leaves his hand, you've got an uncertain region. Think of like an area around the catcher's mitt where you don't know when it first comes off his fingers where it's going. And so it's very uncertain. It's a very big, could hit the batter, could go over here, could go over there. Then as you get more measurements of it moving towards the things, you start to reduce the uncertainty, that area around the catcher's mitt. And does it move? When it shrinks, the probability of hitting the catcher's mitt, Earth, actually goes up first if the catcher's mitt stays in that uncertain area. And then as it gets smaller and smaller, you hope that the uncertainty, if it's Earth, not a catcher's mitt, it goes off of the catcher's mitt or Earth. Sorry for the possibly strained metaphor. And once the uncertain area goes off the catcher's mitt, it drops to zero. But as long as the catcher's mitt stays in it, that keeps going up. So your uncertain area of where the asteroid is going to fly through relative to Earth in 2032 is big enough to include Earth now, but it's starting to get smaller. And the first thing that happens, as long as Earth stays in the uncertain area, is it goes up. And then suddenly that uncertain area will drop, suddenly, using the term loosely, will drop off the edge of the Earth, and you'll be like, yes, the worst we've got is a really close path. And then it gets smaller and smaller, and it's farther away, and you're good. But it causes a situation that leads to freaking out of like, oh my gosh, the percentage is going up, which makes you think we're in trouble. But I mean, we may be, we have a 2% chance of that, but we'll see as the uncertainty changes.
And that's actually what happened over the weekend. I was hanging out, scrolling my phone when I saw an article come in through CNN that's like, the chance of this thing hitting us just went up to 2%. So that makes a lot of sense and makes it hopefully less scary for people.
Yeah, no, it was good because even though everyone in the planetary defense field knows this, I looked really smart by having a quote saying, hey, it might go up first. Of course, I'll look bad if it ends up hitting, but I don't think anyone will remember by then.
That's true. Kate said that the way that we kind of classify these objects and their danger level is on something called the Torino Impact Hazard Scale. Can you describe what that scale is kind of like what range of numbers we're looking at?
0 to 10. 10 is extremely bad, like, you know, dinosaur killer kind of thing that's going to hit. 0 is it's going to miss. And the lower numbers represent, it's a combination scale. It combines the probability of impact at that time, like measured today, and you would get the probability of impact and then the size of the object, which will determine, as well as its velocity, how much damage it would do if it did hit. So bigger numbers are higher probabilities and bigger objects. So this is a, to use the term used often in the community, a city killer. So if it comes in over a city, it destroys the city. But that's kind of disturbingly on the small scale of things that could really cause damage. But on the really small scale, you've got a Chelyabinsk where you do an airburst and you do some damage. And then you've got something like this that's more like a Tunguska in 1908 that leveled 2,000 square kilometers of forest. So that's 1.5 times the size of the city of Los Angeles, for reference. And we don't know the exact size, but basically what it's telling you is, hey, you've got a 1-2% somewhere. You've got a very few percent chance of hitting, and you've got an object that's in the 50 to 100 meter-ish type range. And so we give it this such and such a number. If the probability goes up above a certain point, they will increase that. The size shouldn't change, even though we're uncertain by like a factor of 2 on the size, which is not at all uncommon, because we basically just have a brightness and we don't know how bright or dark the object is. So that's what right now size is calculated from. So anyway, it was developed in what's sometimes called Turin in Italy at a conference, which is referred to as Torino. And so it became the Torino scale.
Oh.
What it really is not for the scientists, but more a threat level, combined threat level to communicate to the public. But depending on how much time you have to explain it, it may communicate it or it may just confuse it. But
fair.
We're in the low range, but not non-zero. This is the highest anything's gotten since Apophis, which made it to a 4. This can only make it to a 3 because it's not as big.
It's kind of remarkable that in all of the near-Earth objects we've found, and it's like 37,000 at this point, that this one happens to have the highest rate, at least for now, of its chance to hit us. And even then, it's still very low. So this makes me feel a lot safer, and I'll feel even better when Neo Surveyor is up there checking everything out for us.
Yeah, I can make you feel less safe if you want, but...
plenty of things.
It's still a low probability of impact, and that's why we have trouble getting people to take it seriously. So that's why, in that respect, if it's not going to hit, we obviously don't want it to hit, but if it's not going to hit, it's like Apophis. It's a good educational moment to say, hey, don't forget about these. This is a natural disaster that could be really huge, and it's different than a hurricane or earthquake. We can actually prevent this with enough work over time, or at least seriously mitigate the amount of damage. And we're getting there, but we found 35,000-ish of the so-called near-Earth objects, which measures how close they come to Earth in their orbit. There are about 1 million that are capable of causing damage on the surface of the Earth. So we have a ways to go. Now, some of those are Chelyabinsk-sized, which still injured over 1,000 people and broke glass. So not a fun toy, but on the smaller end, you've got those. And the good news... The good news, besides the fact that these don't happen very often, is there's a lot more little stuff than big stuff, which is why we have 50, 100 tons of material hit the Earth every day. But it's lots of little tiny stuff that burns up, makes pretty little meteors. And it's only occasionally you get the kind of big stuff. And then it's really only occasionally you get the really, really big stuff.
Man, that's a lot of stuff falling to Earth every single day. I don't know if I've ever heard like how much stuff in bulk actually hits us. That's
well,
cool.
Let's go ahead and make that the random space fact. No, I'll give you something else, but that's kind of wild.
That is wild. Well, all right. What is our actual random space fact?
Random space fact.
I'm getting a little crazy in my interpretations of random space fact, but this is something I think is neat. When you're looking at James Webb Space Telescope images, JWST, of the planets, you will notice that the planets often, the ones they release, the planets often appear dark. So like Saturn looks dark, the rings look bright. It gets even stranger when you look at Neptune, where Neptune looks dark, and little Triton, which is big for a moon, but not the otherwise, looks super bright. And that's because they're showing you a methane band is dominating what they're doing. So methane sits there in the atmosphere and makes it look blue, but it also loves to absorb near infrared light. And so when we're looking in the near infrared, there's not much coming back from the sunlight to see from those, whereas Triton's covered with nitrogen ice and the like, and Saturn's rings are mostly water ice. And so at these particular wavelengths off in the 2-micron land, they don't. So it causes a very different look than when we look normally, and can be rather surprising in the result. So that's a little something if you look up your JWST planetary images of the giant planets.
They're some of the most beautiful images. I mean, you can't really beat things like Voyager going right up to the planets and taking full color images that we can see in the visual spectrum. But you get to reveal some really cool details with these other band passes. And I love those images of Uranus and Neptune so much because we haven't had an opportunity to see them in that level of detail in decades.
Yep, it's pretty. And for example, the rings. I mean, the rings of Neptune are very, very hard to see from Earth. And that shows them very clearly. And so it's opening up a whole new world, even in our solar system, not to mention the things they're doing in the distant universe. No, really, we're not going to mention the things they do in the distant universe.
Oh, really, though? There's so much wacky science going on with JWST right now. But I love it. Every new discovery is mind-blowing and weird and changing our paradigms. And
it's wild, and it's so cool. And it's such an engineering marvel. It's certainly one of the ones that I fortunately incorrectly predicted. There's no way they can make that work. It's so complicated, but it's magnificent. They did it.
They absolutely did.
All right, everybody, go out there, look in the night sky. Think about lemons and oranges and other citrus. I don't know why. Thank you and good night.
We've reached the end of this week's episode of Planetary Radio, but we'll be back next week with Haley Arsenault, the first pediatric cancer survivor in space. She'll talk about her books, Wild Ride, and her new kids' book, Astronaut Haley's Brave Adventure. If you love the show, you can get Planetary Radio t-shirts at planetary.org/shop, along with lots of other cool spacey merchandise. Help others discover the passion, beauty, and joy of space science and exploration by leaving a review and a rating on platforms like Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Your feedback not only brightens our day, but helps other curious minds find their place in space through Planetary Radio. You can also send us your space thoughts, questions, and poetry at our email at planetaryradio@planetary.org. Or if you're a Planetary Society member, leave a comment in the Planetary Radio space in our member community app. Planetary Radio is produced by the Planetary Society in Pasadena, California, and is made possible by our dedicated members from all around the world. Mark Hilverta and Ray Pauletta are our associate producers. Andrew Lucas is our audio editor. Josh Doyle composed our theme, which is arranged and performed by Peter Schlosser. And until next week, Ad Astra.